Who killed the electric car? That question will be answered next by the director of the same titled documentary, Mr. Chris Payne, on The Culture Catch. Today's podcast is brought to you by our friends at Mother Earth News, the original guide to living wisely, MotherEarthNews.com. Joining me today on The Culture Catch is the director, Chris Payne, of the new documentary, Who Killed the Electric Car? Chris, thank you for joining us on The Culture Catch.
Oh, it's great to be here.
So who did kill the... I know it's a big, expansive question. You guys do a very, very thorough job answering all the facets and the machinations of who might have killed the electric car, and we'll get into that. I had a question, though, right out of the gate. What was your biggest expense producing this movie besides your time commitment? Because it looked like you spent 10-plus years, perhaps, on this project.
Well, it's definitely a three-year project. The last year and a half were the most intense. We started working on the film right when they started taking electric cars off the road. You know, the interesting thing is most people don't even know there were electric cars. And that's it's a nice thing to be in your program, just to let folks know that General Motors, of all companies, designed perhaps the most advanced car in the world that ever designed. And the other car companies joined them. And then they took the cars off the road after about 5 years for a bunch of reasons that the movie explores. And so we decided to get to the bottom of what it was with the electric car that they didn't like so much.
Well, now you and your producer both had electric cars, correct? So you had the passion firsthand, right?
Yeah.
So it wasn't like hearsay, I'm going to jump on the bandwagon. You guys were actually excited consumers.
Yeah.
As were most of the enthusiasts in the cars, celebrities included, Mel Gibson and Peter Norton.
Tom Hanks,
right. So, I mean, it's like ripping away your security blanket in some sense. A car is a security blanket for many of us.
Well, it's kind of sad. I mean, I've really never been a car guy, but I got this electric car, and it just blew me away. And anybody who lived in California who made all these little requirements, and you didn't have to be famous to get one, but you really had to know about it. And I just happened to know about it on sort of a fluke chance. I had heard that this famous engineer had designed an amazing car, and so I went out and got one. And we just had a great time. I mean, I wanted to show this car to all my friends on the East Coast and overseas, like, what's it like? So I started filming, you know, my experience with the car.
And, so at this point, you didn't have any inkling that this might become a documentary?
No. It's just like I was doing a
serendipitous.
Sort of, yeah. I think when they started... they started taking the cars away, and when we say, why are you taking the cars away? And they go, oh, nobody liked this car. Electric cars aren't the right time and the right place, and it doesn't work very well. It's like, what are you talking about? It's the best car you ever did. So that's when the idea of a film started.
Yeah. My friend Hart Bachner had one, and I know that he was just as anguished as the rest of the EV users were, and really impassioned and really got on the bandwagon, the letter writing campaign and everything. He just couldn't understand why the rug got pulled out underneath. I mean, I think there's no harm in we can explore some of these topics
right now.
You know, when I watched the movie, I thought, my God, they've built a car that has replaced every other automobile. There goes the automobile parts industry. There goes really the old fail-safe, let's use it for a couple of years and then scrap it to the junkie. They really built a lasting, wonderful car. And when you examine it on that level, you go, I've just bought a car that could last 20 years.
Yeah.
But without all the working mechanical parts. You don't need air filters. You don't need oil changes. You don't need any of these things. Maybe, as you said, you rotate the tires And the fuel cells, I guess, like any battery, can go bad after a while. So that
Batteries are really the one expensive replacement part in an electric car, but they've got that technology so good now, they're not talking about it. But even Toyota is warranting the batteries on their gas electric hybrids for 100,000 miles or 10 years or something like this. I mean, batteries are very robust. And with an electric car, because you have no internal combustion engine, there's nothing to really fix. There's no transmission, no carburetor. It's just charge the batteries up and they make the motor go.
Just like the little toy cars that you would buy your children at a Toys R Us or something. I mean, it's really that simple. You plug it in and they juice up. Now,
That's simple, but unlike the toy, I mean, these electric cars, because of the way they're designed, are incredibly fast.
Right.
And people always think, oh, it's a golf car, there's all these limitations, and it really isn't.
No, they go 0 to 60 in like 3.5 seconds or something,
the
4 seconds.
Ones, yeah,
the new ones.
Yeah, and even the EV1, which came out in 1995, would go to 0 to 60 in, you know, like 8 seconds.
That's amazing. You start with a funeral procession in your documentary, which is just genius, and you feel... Like somebody said last night, somebody tapped you on the shoulder and you said, you made me cry about a car, you know, an inanimate object. And you do feel this incredible sadness that here's GM, this giant corporation that could create something so liberating for so many of us. I mean, ecologically alone, that should suffice.
Right.
But on so many different levels, economically, liberating. And you'd think, does a profit margin really mean that much to corporate America? I guess it does.
Well, you know, car companies are so used to building the same old thing every year, and the electric car was a real challenge for the car industry. It wasn't just GM, but Toyota went after these things, Honda, everybody, all the car makers ganged up on the electric car to take it off the road. And it's because an electric car threatens the building block of the auto industry, which is, you know, spare parts and and I think that when we had our cars taken away, it's like, oh, you know, a bunch of crying Hollywood celebrities lose their cars and stuff. And on one level, sure, it's like, please don't take my car away because I like my car. It's part of who I am. But another, it's like sort of just a sad thing, like, why can't we get out of the 20th century? You know, why are we so stuck with gasoline and internal combustion engines? I think that was sort of the deeper sadness.
And you have this great juxtaposition in the beginning where you see these cars come over the horizon. And in the background, very cleverly, wind power. The windmills, which is, you know, obviously if you've done any driving out west and you get into that area of California and you see the wind power and you think, this is really embracing the 21st century, you know, the fuel cells and everything, you know, all of the eco-friendly devices for generating power. We don't have to be dependent on coal and fossil fuels.
Right. I mean, that's the great thing about a battery-powered electric car is that you can charge it renewably, and especially in, you know, places that get more sun, like California, Arizona. But even in overcast states, as our solar expert talks about, you can charge a car off the roof of your house, and then you never go to the gas station. You just charge up when you come home. And sure, that's not for everybody, but that wind power can really move a lot of our transportation fleet.
Now, when the car was first developed, Roger Smith was the CEO. Of GM, right? And most of us have seen Roger and May, so we know where Rob. But I'm quite curious, when he left, had they already implemented the recall program in the new, or was it the new CEO of GM?
Yeah, that Roger Smith thing is so funny for us, because last night, you know, I got to meet Michael Moore for the first time, and I want to talk to him about Roger Smith, because Roger Smith, for all the, you know, damage he created by closing so many of those plants in Michigan at the time, he also was a visionary, and he kicked off the electric car. And many believe that he was thrown out of GM for this electric car program, which he basically told the world that he was going to produce. And car companies often have concept cars, but they don't want to actually produce them. And Roger Smith pushed it on the electric car, and the board threw him out shortly thereafter.
So perhaps he had a change of heart after seeing the documentary, and he wanted to be altruistic to humanity, and he paid the price.
I don't know about that, but...
I'm speculating.
But he was, in my view, he's partially vindicated. He really did try to lead the company, and he's kind of a maverick. So.
And how about some of the other maverick car designers, like the Shelbys of the world? How did they embrace, or how have they embraced this technology? Have you talked to any of the really hotshot car designers?
Yeah.
The combustible engine car designers?
Well, what people love, the people from traditional car design love about the electric car is that you can have this incredible performance. And it's strange that a lot of the hybrids coming out, instead of emphasizing their miles per gallon, at least last year, they're emphasizing how high-performance vehicles they were.
Wow.
Because when you have electricity boosting the gas engine even further, you have this incredible torque. So these guys love that stuff. And I think now that the zeitgeist is changing, we're like, hold on, I care more about my miles per gallon than necessarily my speed. That conversation's changing.
And we know in film, timing is everything. And you've got Al Gore's movie out.
Right.
You've got gas prices skyrocketing. You couldn't be in a better space right now, really, for tapping into the zeitgeist of the American consciousness with this movie. What would you hope Americans would walk away from this movie experience?
Well, I hope people get to see the movie. You know, if you watch television, you'll see, like, you count the car commercials. And the car industry really doesn't want the conversation about electric cars on the table. They didn't report the story when it happened. When we got these cars, nobody really knew about them. I mean, most people never heard of the electric car. When they took away the cars and destroyed them, they didn't report that story.
It was
either.
A blip. I don't recall it myself in New York, as liberal a town as we are.
Yeah.
And that's a shame.
It is a shame. And even now, this movie is almost totally dependent on buzz and internet, because we'll do a story for local news, and by the time it gets to the press, to television, it sounds like the GM press release about the electric car. And the story goes like this. We made electric cars, we spent $1 billion, and nobody wanted them. End of experiment. It's the same thing the oil industry said about it, the same thing the car industry, and it's not the whole story.
Now, what could you do to refute that claim just right now? I mean, how many people actually had demands for the car when they were first manufactured? You have the wonderful spokeswoman who was brought in from the Saturn division to spearhead the Southern California marketing movement. And I mean, you've got a passionate talking head there. She's I'm sorry, I forget her name.
Chelsea.
Yeah. Fantastic. I mean, she's fought the good fight. She continues to, you know, rage into the night.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and there was that issue with the demand wasn't there. But the demand was there. She was taking the orders, physically taking the orders, in just one sector of this population.
Yeah. Well, Chelsea's a great story. She worked for General Motors. She's a rah-rah employee. And GM treated, and there's a lot of loyalty at GM. They treat their employees very well, or they did, I guess I could say. And when they killed the program, they let her go. And she eventually became, really, I think to her great surprise, an activist on the outside saying, hey, GM, what the hell did you do? So she was a great find for us. So we had so many interviews canceled at GM, and nobody would talk to us there. And then we got Chelsea involved. And Tom Everhart, who was on the board of directors.
Right, Tom, exactly.
Yeah, and that was a huge coup for us. And he told us about what GM was thinking when they decided to axe their electric and hybrid programs in the 90s. And it's really sad to see what's happened to GM.
Why don't you delve into that a little deeper so you can share that with the audience?
Well, at the time, you know, the car companies were fighting the state of California. And they said, we don't want to have to put electric cars on the road. But back in the boardroom, they were having these debates. And they said, do you think there's any chance the hybrid or electrics are going to take off? And they go, no, Toyota's losing a ton of money on the Prius. Let's just let it roll on the SUV. And all these car companies let it roll on the SUV. And I was just astonished that not one guy from Anderson or Price Coopers or some Harvard guy said, hey, guys, what about if gas prices hit $3 or $4? Americans will want an alternative, and unfortunately the leadership there didn't see that.
That's extraordinary to me. And gas, as we know, is fueling the combustible engine. So what was the biggest surprise for you when you really started getting into the project?
Well, I think my biggest surprise, and I guess I'm somewhat naive, but I was surprised to see the amount of effort that went into trying to discredit the electric car when it was on the road. The oil industry spent tons of money basically advertising against electric cars, and then hiring these phony groups that say Californians against, you know, utility companies, and so all this sort of flack. And when corporations use public relations to change what society is trying to do, I think it can be very destructive, and that was my biggest surprise.
What was your biggest joy in completing the movie?
Well, the biggest joy has been this idea that this story now can be told and shared, and so that people sitting around can have a conversation about electric cars and have some tools to really have a deep conversation about it. And I hope that conversation happens in Detroit and in government, too. If they have to bail out car companies, this should be part of the solution.
Yeah, because GM is not in good shakes right now.
Yeah, I guess their annual meeting is today. I'm looking forward to seeing what they say. maybe they'll bring in the plug-in hybrid. That's what
maybe they will. Yeah, and let's talk about the hybrid for a second. How do you think that is that a perfect marriage? You think for the high concept, or I mean, in my mind. As a consumer, I'd say, why even bother with a hybrid? Let's just go back to the electric. Let's just embrace this technology. We know that hydrogen is an inferior answer to energy, and the electric car just makes so much sense. I'm wondering if maybe a foreign company, let's say a BMW or a Mercedes, completely hit the market with the ultimate driving experience with an electric car. Do you think that would then sway the rest of the car manufacturers?
Well, I think the GM hit the ultimate car with their EV1 in the 90s when it came out.
They did it anyway.
They did it, and the car industry just saw it as a threat. I think now with oil prices higher and hybrids really taking off at Toyota and Honda, and even with the Ford Escape, people were going, huh, maybe electricity could work on the industrial level. Here's the deal with hybrids. I mean, hybrids now still run on gasoline, which is why they're the ultimate compromise for the oil industry,
right,
in my view.
You still need parts. You still need the fuel.
In fact, maybe even more parts, because now you have an engine and a motor.
Right.
But the good thing about the hybrid is that it gets people used to the idea of electricity in their car. And you'll see people with hybrids, and they'll be almost trying to keep the car in electric mode all the time.
Right.
And hopefully
don't drive too fast, because once you hit that certain speed limit, right, the motor kicks in.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be that way. Actually, it'd be coolest if you'd let the electricity give you the speed,
right,
and the gasoline give you the longevity, but that's not the way it's designed. But you know, going forward, right, the great hope for these cars is that they become plug-in hybrids, because this way, you plug in your car at night, and the next morning you're driving 50 miles off your battery power, never using a drop of gasoline.
Now, that's one of the knocks on the car, that you do have a limited range. You know, a friend of mine brought up a very interesting point. He said, what happens if you run your car all day, it's your only vehicle, and God forbid you have to run out in the middle of the night, you don't have a charge, you have an emergency, hospital visit or something.
Yeah. Well, that was always when I got that car, that's exactly what I was afraid of. And it's funny what happens is, once you know what the limitations of a car are, quote limitations, you never have the problem.
You prepare for it.
You're just ready. It's like sort of intuitive. And the other thing I didn't realize, but that the national average for how many miles people drive is 30 miles or less. So when you have an electric car that only goes 100 miles on a charge, well, it turns out that 9 times out of 10, that's plenty. And, you know, for people getting familiar with this, the electric car is the perfect second car. But what people find is after a couple of days, it becomes their primary car, and their gas car is their backup car.
Right, right. So how many actually were manufactured in the end? Did you ever get a full count?
Well, GM manufactured about 1,100 of the cars.
That's it?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I think there were about 5,000 cars total between Toyota and Honda and Ford and Chrysler and GM.
That's it? I thought it was much more.
Well, they were supposed to, if they hadn't gone after this law like they did, there'd be 1 million cars on the road in California alone today in 2006. And instead there's like 300 because they destroyed all the rest of them.
Unbelievable. So 1,100 were destroyed?
Well,
in the first round or even more?
You know, we don't actually know what happened to every car. You know, it's just a huge fluke that we took the helicopter trip and we discovered
that's an unbelievable sequence when you see these cars stacked up, smashed, beautiful cars smashed to pulverine.
I know.
It's just
breaks your heart. It was really, I was so happy and I was so sad at the same moment, because I knew that for the film it'd be a really great moment. Yeah. And it was
like Area 51 and finding the UFO finally. What would be the actual cost of replacing the battery in an electric car? Did you ever find out from the engineers?
Well, there's all kinds of massive, you know, variations in these prices. And the story about batteries is what kind of battery you have in the car. And the cheapest batteries are lead-acid batteries, which we already have millions of.
You can buy
those
at Sears. And
Yeah. And the guys doing conversions, who take like an old used car and drop the engine, put in batteries, they have a good success. They can do that for like $6,000, $8,000 worth of parts, including the motor and everything. If you're talking about lithium-ion batteries and some of these fancier batteries, the price goes up. But I've seen a lot of studies, and it comes down to this. A battery pack is about the equivalent cost as an engine. And you make it in mass quantity, it's not that expensive. $5,000, $6,000, something like this. But it goes up or down depending on what you want to do.
Right. Now, that you brought up something, a very good point, that there are engineers out there and mechanics that are doing these conversions. Hmm. And what would be the total cost then on the conversion for somebody? Let's say you wanted to outfit one of your favorite frames of a car.
Yeah. Well, there's not a lot of people with this expertise yet. And I think if you got a mechanic to do it, the parts, I think, that Greg quoted us, that guy at Left Coast Conversions, is something like $8,000 in parts, and then his labor is going to be at least another $8,000.
Right. So that's not cheap. But when the EV came out, what was the sticker price on the EV?
Well, they would never sell them.
They'd only lease.
Yeah, and some people say that's because they knew they were going to kill them all along.
So they always had that fail-safe plan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so they said, okay, well, your lease was up. You go, great, I'm going to, buy it. What's the residual? And they go, oh, no option to buy. Well, what? Why not?
So you only had a three-year lease top.
Yeah, 3 years. Well, actually, they extended my lease another 2 years.
Oh, they did?
Yeah. So I had my car for 5 years. So right. Something like
what,
that.
What year did you lose it?
I think 2003, maybe the end of 2002. I can't quite remember.
Right. Did you immediately go out and buy a hybrid?
I was very lucky because Toyota briefly sold their electric RAV4 conversion car, RAV4 EV, and it was available, and so I bought one. So that's my primary car now, is a Toyota electric car.
And they didn't get into the whole recall effort.
Oh, they sure did. And they destroyed.
Oh, they did.
Yeah, they destroyed most of their cars too.
Unbelievable. So how did you get around having your car destroyed?
Because
you just bought it outright.
The ones they sold,
they couldn't
take
do anything.
Them. Yeah.
And so you have, how long does it take you to recharge the battery on yours?
Well, if I drove it right to zero, zero power, it's barely crawling back in my garage, which never happens, about 4 hours. But what you find is that you usually use 30 miles, you charge it for a half an hour, you're out
You
the
just
road.
Get your cell phone.
Yeah.
When you're not using it, it's plugged in.
Exactly.
So what is the cost then for charging a car
right.
electrically, your monthly statement from...
From PG&E or what's the
name? Con Ed here in
Con
New York.
Con Ed, yeah. Well, the back of the envelope number is about the equivalent of 60 cents a gallon, 65 cents a gallon. But the deeper answer has to do with what time of day you charge your car. It turns out that if you charge your car at night when the utilities aren't using as much power, between 11 p.m., you put it on a timer, and 6 a.m., there's tons of available power that the network can't use. And in fact, they say that you can charge 30 million cars every night without adding any additional power plants, just now using excess capability.
Nationally or just
nationally?
Nationally.
Yeah.
That's extraordinary.
It's huge. And the price of that is not very much. Now, if you say, I'm going to charge my car when everybody's using their air conditioning in New York in August or something, that's more expensive.
And that's pretty much 24/7, unfortunately, in August.
In August, it is.
Yeah. I mean, so obviously it would be more. And that was one of the points a lot of the New Yorkers raised last time. Well, this would be great, but where would we charge in New York? I mean,
right.
Unless you had a private garage that had the devices built into the infrastructure, would we have little charging stations all over New York? Would they be vandalized? There are all these concerns in a major metropolitan area like New York,
right.
Where you don't have that in California, where you could convert an old filling station or these meters. And you see that great shot with those little mini charging stations. Where was that?
At LAX.
That was at LAX.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Well, the amazing thing is, unlike hydrogen, you can build an electric charging station very simply. And you can put it pretty much anywhere. You can put them in parking garages. All you have to do is connect to 220, and you've got it.
Right.
And in fact, the really cool designs are
It's just a 220.
Yeah, 220.
Well, I had no idea.
That's
an air conditioner, is a 220.
220 or a washing machine or something.
Yeah.
And if you run out of power, I would be at my girlfriend's house or something, and she didn't have a charger, they had a little one that you plug into the wall at home next to the television set. And instead of taking
an adapter.
And then it would take 12 hours to charge, but
right.
In an emergency.
Why not?
Right.
Now, how about some of the solar applications with it? Was there any hybrid solar, using the solar energy to charge the...
Oh, yeah. A lot of people in California would basically put solar systems on their house. And then the roof of their house would collect all the energy for their car and charge it at night.
And be no cost or a fraction.
Well, you'd be paying the amortized price of the solar cells over 10 years.
Right, of course.
And so that's a real cost. And really the cheapest electricity is wind, which can come down to 3 cents a kilowatt hour.
Wow.
And completely underutilized.
There was something very, very funny when they showed the car commercials, which obviously never migrated anywhere. I don't know, were they ever aired? They look like Tim Burton goth car commercials. They were like as far removed from anything enticing.
Yeah.
I mean, they were cool on one level, but it was like, I don't know, it was kind of a haunting image of...
Yeah. Well, that was
where did you find those? Those are fantastic.
It was a print campaign that GM did. And then they did, I think, Hal Rani designed them. I don't have every detail about those ads, but it was an award-winning photographer did these photographs. And a lot of people believed, and you can make the judgment for yourself when you see the movie or anybody listening sees the movie, about what the real intent of those ads were, because they certainly look like post-apocalyptic world.
Like, yeah, it was like AI, Spielberg's vision of the future.
Like after nuclear war, an electric car is a great idea.
Yeah, right, when there's nothing to plug into anyway, right?
But the actual piece that we used was a made-for-television spot that ran, I believe, briefly in the mid-90s.
So what was your biggest expense producing the movie? The music? You said a lot of source music. I mean, just strictly on now, just on a filmmaking side.
Yeah. Yeah, music's always a big expense.
People forget that music can just completely eat up a budget.
It did. And then we shot all of our interviews in HD.
You did, right. You did have different source material, but you did match it very well.
Yeah.
Because I saw like 3-chip cameras and...
Yeah, we had everything.
Yeah.
And our post-digital house, you know, up-resed all of our low-budget footage and
right.
What we called, can we swear on this? Yeah, we called it shitty cam. So everything that was really low, you know, upgrade shitty cam to like HD quality.
Right.
That's
time. Color correction can be expensive too.
Color correction,
that must be...
transfer to film.
Right.
So it adds up.
How long did it take you to edit the movie?
We started editing right before Burning Man, August, something like that. So like 6 months.
And now your first film festival, was it Sundance or was there a...
Sundance.
What was the reaction after Sundance?
Sundance was such an amazing experience. And, I've been to Sundance a couple of times, but you get there and, you know, like they put on your laminate and you're the director. You walk around, you feel like you're like a, you know, after being in an editing room for 6 months, you don't really want to see anybody. So your social skills are out the window. But we walked in for that premiere, and you know, Larry David was there, and Lori David, and there was buzz about this and that, and the other thing, and the audience was huge. We got a giant standing ovation, and I probably sounded like an idiot because I was just so bowled over. Because you don't know, you know, you make a film and you hope that it like touches it, but at the end of the day, it might not work, and I think that was a real vindication.
So that begins the word of mouth. Now, what's been the trickle down effect? How has that impacted corporate America? Are people now talking about it? Are the car companies and the automobile industry folks and the oil industry folks, have you heard any backlash? Or has it just been so buttoned up?
Big industry has learned that the right way to deal with documentaries that are, you know, that they don't like is
not to react at all.
And maybe quietly pressure advertisers not to cover the thing and just like sweep it under the table.
So it's kind of a coup that Sony is distributing the movie.
Yes.
I mean, that's a major coup. Not kind of. It's a major coup that Sony is putting their neck out on the chopping block.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. Sony took a big gamble on this. And I think they saw that we really did our research. And, you know, I brought in a producer from Frontline who just, our facts are solid. We're not just making shit up. This is the real deal. This is what happened. And Sony said, well, you know, gas prices are going up. People are pissed about the way things are going. This movie might hit it. And plus, it's accurate. Let's go for it.
You know, I obviously, the DVD market will be very, very big on this. And I think the word of mouth, and as you said, the internet, shows like this, and we can link this, and people can start to share this interview, and it's in itself becomes a great barker for your documentary.
And plus, people get a quick trip to New York City with the bottle machine here.
That's your next documentary, man. The noise level in New York from the simple interview. What else would you like people to walk away with, Chris, from watching this?
I want people to walk away feeling like they have information they can use to make better decisions and informed decisions. We had one audience say, hey, well, you can't criticize consumers for not buying the electric car because we never saw it on a commercial. And, you know, all of us get a little complacent because the last thing I have time to think about is my friggin' car sometimes. But it's part of the solution is getting out of the way of our own habits.
Now, you know, Governor Schwarzenegger has been criticized both left and right for his position on the environment. I really don't even know where he stands. You know, the Republicans think he's too soft and the liberals think he's not hardline enough for the problems that California has with emissions and everything. What's your feeling? I mean, I don't want you to put your neck on the chopping block here.
Well, you know, Schwarzenegger's in our movie. You know, we went to film him, and I think Arnold is actually well intentioned on the environment. I just think that he was pretty much misled and given bad advice about hydrogen fuel cell. A hydrogen fuel cell is not a technology that is available today, and the forces against the electric car pretty much use that as a bait and switch to kill the electric car program in California and replace it with a technology that is 10 years out at the earliest, probably 20 by the time you get down to real bus. And the great thing about hydrogen for an oil industry is that instead of electricity that anybody can plug into their house, is you need to have a refinery, you need to like ship hydrogen around, you need to like pump it at the gas station or whatever, and it fits their business model. But it doesn't fit the business model of what's best for the country.
Very good answer. Oh, you know, the one question, I'm sorry, I want to backtrack, because I asked it last night. We briefly touched on the European model, the hybrid car, and we talked about this. GM actually came out with a hybrid car in Europe that they won't release here, which is often the case. You see much more interesting designs and fuel efficiency cars in Europe than you do in America. Why is that?
Well, I mean, here's one of the lessons for that I've learned in the film, and that is that government is not always a force for bad. And in Europe, and even in Russia and China, they have more strict emission standards than we do here. I mean, miles per gallon standards. So the fact that the car industry has kept miles per gallon standards to 24 miles per gallon is just insane. And if the car companies know they have to hit a higher benchmark, they do. In Europe, they have to hit a better benchmark. So they have better products for those markets. The thing is they make more money the lower the mileage standard is. So they just fight Congress, and they keep it really low, and we don't get those cars.
Is there anything else you want to add, do you think, to the experience?
No. It's just been a good ride.
A good ride. There you go. There's a perfect metaphor. Don't let all of the circus environment distract you from your mission.
All right.
And continue success. Thanks.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank today's sponsors of the Culture Catch podcast with Chris Payne, Mother Earth News. You deserve to live well. Check out MotherEarthNews.com. Our friends at WebHSP.com. You have a website you need hosted, WebHSP.com. And Frank Collin and the crew at Final Draft, the finest scriptwriting software on the planet. This is Dusty Wright. We'll see you soon. Look for more great podcasts from Culture Catch, including an in-depth interview with Gore Vidal, my sit-down with Tara Patrick, discussing pornography and how it's crossed over to the mainstream world, and much music, art, theater, and literature. CultureCatch.com. Converge.